Discuss, challenge, inform, comment, viewpoint on Talk Radio Europe.
Giles Brown.
Live comment and discussion with studio guests. Viewpoint.
You're listening to Talk Radio Europe, Thierry, your voice in Spain. It is Tuesday, the 8th of August, which means it is Viewpoint, Talk Radio Europe's current affairs programme, with a panel of invited guests joining me. We have a two-hander today because it is August and things are a little bit slower in the newsrooms and I think in the boardrooms around the country. But we have a two-hander today joining me, as always, former ABC correspondent Nathan Thomas. Good morning, Nathan. Good to have you with us.
Good morning. Wonderful to be here. As always.
And recently back from the UK enjoying his summer break, Rex Leyland. Rex, welcome back to Viewpoint.
Good morning, Giles. Thank you for inviting me on the show.
As always. If you want to be involved with the show, get involved with the show. Always good to hear your calls and your messages. 952-78-4000 is the phone number. studio@talkradioeurope.com is the email. And the Facebook page, should you wish to leave a post, is Talk Radio Europe Official. On today's show, we're going to be looking at the dialer tapes. We're going to be looking at the row over the sprinter Justin Gatland getting a gold medal. Should drugs cheats be allowed back in after a period of forgiveness? And we'll be looking at a recent recommendation that parents limit, now the summer holidays are with us, parents limit the time that their children spend online. Be really looking forward to your comments on that one. 952-78-4000, the phone number, studio@talkradioeurope.com, the email, and Talk Radio Europe Official, the Facebook post. But we start, as we often do, with the latest coming out of the UK with regards to Brexit. There's now a report, the source unclear, that the government is willing to pay £39 billion as an exit fee from the EU. Nathan, your thoughts? It's supposed to be the quiet period politically, but something tells me this summer may be a little bit different to normal.
Well, I think this is part of it. It's politically, it's not quiet because the politicians keep on talking. The whole Brexit negotiation is kind of sitting there because, as you said, it's August. Not a lot is happening. I'm sure there are some who are working away in the background with it, and that's fine. But different people, for different reasons, are putting out different information at this point. One is the latest one, and we've heard numbers everywhere from the UK will pay $100 billion to the EU, or that's what the EU wants them to pay. This latest one says $39 billion as an exit fee or whatever you want to call it. Again, no one seems to know where that particular number came from. It's all within the UK. So until the negotiators actually sit down with the EU negotiators and work this out, that number is no more relevant than the $100 billion or the zero amount that other politicians say that the UK should pay. So it's nothing, but it keeps the whole thing keeps generating conversation. And some people say, well, yes, we do owe something because of the way the budgets are done and so on. Others say, well, we're just leaving. We owe nothing. The UK can't, it seems, decide what they want to do, what they are willing to do. This is one group saying, yes, we'll pay $39 billion. Others say no. So until the UK figures out what they want to do, not just on this issue, but all the other ones, the negotiations, it seems, are not going to get very far if the negotiators don't know what they're really, really working for.
I mean, we go back to that point, don't we, at the moment, that nobody's actually quite sure what the exit strategy seems to be at the moment coming out from number 10, and we won't know until they come back.
Well, we won't know. Even then, we won't know. And I don't know that there's any reason that number 10 and the rest of the government needs or should tell the general public before the negotiations are complete what their strategy is, because that seems to be a very bad way to negotiate anything. So I don't know. They may have a strategy that, fine, they talk to the public and they say this, that, and the other thing, and there really is a strategy there. And behind the scenes, it is proceeding along. We just have to wait and see. Of course, what will happen at some point, the negotiators, the real negotiators, will come up with what they think is the best deal, and the EU negotiators, the UK negotiators will say, okay, this is the best one, neither one of us are particularly happy with it, which is generally the signs of a pretty good negotiation. Neither of us are happy with it, but we can live with it. And then a number will come out, And then, of course, the screaming will start all over again. So in some ways, now we're screaming before we know anything. Once we do know something, then the screaming will start all over again, because there's always going to be people who are not happy with whatever the decisions are.
Rex, you just come over from the UK. You're a man who has worked in business in the capital all of your life. What are your thoughts on where we are and what is the man on the street, a very nice street, obviously, somewhere in London, thinking at the current rate of progression or lack of with the negotiation?
Well, to answer the main point about this $39 billion, whether or not we should be paying it, reminds me of the times that sometimes when you close up down a bank account and the bank have the audacity to charge you a departure fee, or if you've invested some money in the bank and you decided you want to put it somewhere else, and you say, well, I want to take my money out. And they say, fine, but we're going to charge you something for doing that. And you say, well, hold on, it's my money in the first place. And they say, well, that's the rules of the bank. I think really this conjected $39 billion, of course, we won't know anything about it until nearer the time. But in answer to your second question, what do I think? I am, at this stage, rather disappointed about the whole exit procedure. I feel that the government have slightly let us down so far. I think their handling has been pretty dismal. And to be honest, I'm a little worried about the future. I don't have complete confidence in how they're managing this particular strategy. I don't have a lot of faith in the appointees. I think perhaps Dr. Fox is the one that I would trust most at this stage, Liam Fox. They portray, on Dead Ringers on the BBC, they portray Davis as the bashing boy, you know, the rough and tumble, all right, mate, I'm going to get it sorted and all that sort of thing. But nobody's instilling confidence. That's what worries me at this time. There's nothing to reassure me. That's, you know, my immediate take.
One of the people who's talking about bashing boys, one of the people who mentioned that he might be getting back into the fray, Nigel Farage, tweeted on yesterday, in fact, his cabinet ministers are gutless and weak on Brexit. I will come back to frontline politics if Leave voters are betrayed in 2019. Leave voters being betrayed. We've got a caller on the line. 952-78-4000 is the phone number. Good morning, caller. You're live on TRE. What's your name? Where are you calling from? What's your viewpoint, please?
Kate Costablanca.
Morning, Kate.
Morning. There's a lot to say on this one, but I was going to reinforce the last speaker, Rex, except he said that Fox is the only one to have any confidence in. I would say that Fox is equally not inspiring confidence to of the whole lot of them. Two things from a paper commenting on the financial settlement. The EU position papers set out their position. The UK is supposed to respond with their position papers. Then we can start to look at closing the gap. So far, the UK has produced nothing. And then on the costings. The idea is that you agree what things will be under discussion. The EU has put out a position payment paper on that. Nothing's come back from our side. This is really getting quite desperate. And they've all gone on holiday.
I agree. And I mean, the problem is within the cabinet, from just what we hear, and within the government as a whole, they can't agree among themselves what the position is. So, you know, they have nothing to present to the EU because they can't figure out what they want.
I think the bickering between themselves is appalling. And what we're looking for at this time is unity, and we're not getting it.
Well, just another example of that, if you like. To suddenly call a general election just after the 30th of May, March, issuing the number 50 seems to me staggeringly incompetent.
Well, she'll go down in history as probably the worst prime minister, and certainly her judgment was totally lacking. The madness of what she did will live on forever and ever in political history.
Oh, I don't know. She competes quite nicely with Cameron on that. I mean, to one, have an agreed in referendum, and secondly, not made a sort of two-thirds, one-third for a change. You know, it's the bottom line. Anyway, I'm reinforcing the feeling of great unease and lack of confidence in the current government.
I hope by the time they all get back from holiday, they'll have recharged their batteries and perhaps give us a little bit more what we're looking forward to, which is clarity and some positive thinking.
I hope you're right.
Well, the problem is everyone is being clear with their own opinion, and that's what it is. It is this person's opinion, who happens to be a minister of something or other, and someone else who's a minister of something else has their opinion, and they're very clear about what it is, but the government is not functioning as a unified organization, an entity that sits down quietly and decides, this is what our position is, now let's go for it. They haven't reached that point yet.
Kate, thanks very much for your call in. I mean, you could argue that, I mean, a lot of what the government ministers are doing and have done, and this is what Theresa May did quite successfully before in the run-up towards the EU referendum and how she became Prime Minister, is the government ministers now are adopting a submarine policy. They don't want to come above the surface. They don't want to break the surface on Brexit because they know they're going to be shot down if they come in too much on one side or the other. So everybody's sort of lying low and not saying that much about where we should be standing with Brexit.
Well, I'm not sure. I mean, in some ways, it's almost the opposite of that. Where somebody came up with this $39 billion figure. But there are other ministers who are saying we shouldn't have to pay anything, and they're saying that quite adamantly that we don't owe anybody anything. We're leaving. We're out. What they have is what they have, and it's not our problem anymore. Others are, you know, seeming to agree more with the EU that we have made commitments and we have to, you know, abide by those up to a certain extent. And again, it is so very complicated because the amount being paid from the UK into the EU and then the amount that's coming back, this is where you get all the different figures of, yes, they pay this much in, and if you don't count what comes back, it's a very large figure. If you count what comes back, it's a totally different figure. But everybody is out there and has taken a position, it seems, and they just cannot come up with one position for the government, for the country, for the poor negotiators who have to sit down at a table and seemingly don't know what they're looking for.
Right.
But what I find galling is that prior to this disastrous election, the country seemed to be in a very positive mind. We were in a good position. We sort of were holding high in the rest of the world. The economy was doing well. Everything was doing not bad, thank you. And then overnight, everything started to decline. And of course, what it is at the same time is a mental attitude towards the politics of the day. So from a position of strength, we've gone to, as a country, as a nation, we've gone to a position of weakness, and other people can identify this. And Theresa May was undoubtedly stronger before she called the election, but one feels that now she is a lame duck. But the most terrible thing would be for her to call an election again, because it could be utterly disastrous. So unless there is a bit of a reshuffle after the summer, I'm not holding my breath. I'm actually quite nervous about the whole situation. With regards to Mr. Farage, well, of course, he is a phenomenal communicator. He is a great politician, and for the Brexiteers, we owe it to him to get this show on the road. He got the show on the road, and he's right to say that if we are in doubt as to how the wishes of the nation are being carried out, then perhaps it might not be a bad idea for him to jump back in and rescue the sinking ship.
Well, I mean, the thing is, though, I mean, a lot of this was a lot of the voting was done on the fact that we were going to the taking back control was the big thing, and getting away from Europe, deciding Britain's own sovereignty was a major factor. Now, I can't see an awful lot of people in the UK being very happy to wanting to have to pay $39 billion to be divorced from Brussels, and they might do as Boris Johnson said, they might say, well, go whistle. I mean, what do you think? This is going to be a very damaging series of events and a possibility of irreparably damaging our relationship with Europe. We have a caller on the line. I go straight to the lines. Good morning, caller. You're live on TRE. What's your name? Where are you calling from? What's your viewpoint, please?
Good morning, Mr. Brown and everyone. Raymond from Mallorca.
Morning, Raymond.
Brexit, isn't it? Right. It's about that recent news we've had about the €39 billion, £36 billion. Terrible rate of exchange, what? And it keeps going down. Apparently, from what I read on text television, the €39 billion is connected with staying in the single market. That's the condition to it. The British government are prepared to pay that money if we stay in the single market, which is good. You know, they're accepting the fact that we need to stay in. Of course, we have made commitments to Europe about this, you know, about expenditure and future projects. So we obviously know that. Otherwise, we'd offer them nothing. So that's also that's not a negative thing. It's a good. It's the only criticism I've got is usually, you know, my experience of buying and selling, the first offer is not usually the price. So I think they should have gone in lower than that and then allowed it to go up a little bit. From, you know what I mean, negotiating from the Brussels side. Anyway, we'll have to see what happens on that. But it's not that, you know, things are not that bad. The negotiating team we've got, whether they're the best people, I don't know. But they're the ones we've got, and that won't change. You know, obviously, Mr. Farage, he won't be allowed to participate. He's not even an MP. So, I mean, we can just, you know, whatever one thinks, I mean, that can be discounted. I fail to see how before the Brexit referendum, anyone can say we were in a position of strength. We're not. We weren't then, we're not now.
We were the highest performing country in the EU at that time.
No, what you mean is that we're foreign owned, we've got the biggest state debt in Europe, which is now exceeding £1.7 trillion, which after 7 years of Conservative rule has gone up by £200 billion despite the austerity measures and cutbacks. You think that's good? We're foreign owned, we're in debt up to our eyeballs, we're nearly bankrupt. We'll have to borrow this €39 billion euros from the world financial institutions. That's how we survive.
Can I remind you that most of the world is bankrupt, that position will stay until one day, Armageddon, that somebody will call in the debt for every nation in the world, and then they'll just all die away. We're all in debt. That's how we live. That's how America lives. Everybody's in massive debt, and it's fine until somebody decides to call the debt in.
It is not correct. That is not right. There are countries in the European Union that are not in debt. I can think of a few of them. The United States, yes, they're in debt. They have a debt of $20 trillion. They've had it as well. But Germany doesn't have a debt. Denmark, Norway, Sweden, Holland, Austria, Belgium, these countries do not have debts. They're success stories. They are the example we should look at rather than the negative. The negative examples. Now we're in a terrible situation. This is how bad it's going. Last year we manufactured 1.7 million vehicles in the UK, yeah? That's quite good, isn't it?
Not bad at all, I'd say.
Spain are producing more.
Those are official statistics. 1.7 million units last year. Of course, the car industry, as we know, is foreign owned, but it's irrelevant, isn't it? The Spanish, they produced 2,430,000 units, which is 730,000 more than us.
That's correct. I read that this morning in the Sunday Times Business News. That's absolutely correct.
Of course it is. I don't give false information on this programme. I pride myself. 730,000 units more than us. They have one thing in common with us. Their car industry is also totally foreign-owned, yes? They exported 350,000 of those units to us. So, you know, the country of Manana, you go on holiday and the hotel's not finished, all this nonsense. They're actually in front of, they are in front of us, and I still can't see, it doesn't matter how I look at it, through rose-tinted glasses, how I look at it, how the hell can we be the fifth biggest economy in the world? The Spanish economy must be bigger, and there are many countries in front of that as well. This is, what are we doing to ourselves? We're kidding ourselves. We are not capable of taking a reality check, and without this reality check, we have no hope of improving things. We badly need to improve things, but first we have to face reality. We have to look at all the things that need to be done, and we need some form of government that has the common sense and the will. They must have the will to do this. Right. Otherwise, we are on a slippery slope. We can't change the Brexit. That's happening. There's nothing we can do about that. We can debate whether, people do debate whether it's a good idea or not. But I'm British, right? That's my country. It saddens me to see the state of that country. It saddens me to see the fact that that country has been for a long time now ruled by incompetence. It's basically Britain is the dysfunctional leading the dysfunctional. It's a dysfunctional state, and anyone who thinks otherwise, they're living in the past. Here's an example of the past.
We've had
a new film on general release now. This is Britain. This is British. A new film on general release last week. What's it called? Dunkirk. Right? Well, that was a long time ago. That's how bad we are. We're living in the past. Thank you, Brian.
Thank you very much there, Raymond, for your points there.
Thank you, Raymond.
952-78-4000, the phone number. Studio at talkradioeurope.com is the email. The Facebook page is Talk Radio Europe Official. It's interesting, though. We're in the summer break, but we've got less than 2 years. I think we've got 20 months to go before we are officially out of the EU. I was going to say, do government ministers need this break? Shouldn't they be working? I'll come back to this point in a minute after we take this call. Good morning, caller. You're live on TRE. What's your name? Where are you calling from? What's your viewpoint, please?
Good morning. Just to say well done, Raymond. Absolutely every word he said is true. And to add to that, we have some of the lowest productivity in the European Union. We're one of the lowest productivity countries, beaten, by the way, by France and Italy. Productivity-wise, other things obviously dragged the Italian economy down. Well done, Raymond. Thanks a lot. Cheers. Bye.
Thank you there, Sharon. Got an email on studio@talkradioeurope.com. as well from Craig. When will Remainers stop bleating about the economy? No one I know said they voted for Brexit so that the economy would improve. In fact, the main reason voted for were a return of sovereignty, our parliamentary democracy, border control, immigration, and leaving a federal Europe, which we didn't sign up for, to in 1975. A recent poll shows that if necessary, Brexiteers are prepared for a dip in the economy. No doubt all Remainers can't wait to blame the next recession on Brexit. Rex, you're chomping at the bit with that one.
Yes, I think that writer of that particular email is bang on. Simple as that.
Right,
got it spot on.
So it was border control, democracy, immigration, sovereignty, and parliament and parliamentary democracy.
And there'll be no gain without some pain.
No gain.
Regrettably.
But I mean, do you think that our elected members or the UK's elected members of parliament should be taking this break now? I mean, we've got less than 2 years to go before the general elections. The Britain pulls out of the EU. Surely they should be absolutely working tooth and nail to to hammer out some sort of deal. I'll come back to that point again after we take this call. Live on TRE. What's your name? Where are you calling from? What's your viewpoint, please?
This is Steve from Cordoba.
Hello, Steve.
Very surprised by Rex's comments this morning. I fell off my chair when I heard him express his concerns, because I've been saying it for the longest time. But I'd also like to phone up and congratulate Raymond as well. I've been saying the same thing for the longest time. Unfortunately, until we find a proper leadership, the country will be going nowhere. Thank you.
Thank you, Steve. Raymond, you seem to have hit a nerve. So, Nathan, do you think that that the British government should MPs should be taking their long summer breaks now? We've never had an issue like this in the UK. The ambassador to Madrid, our man in Madrid, Simon Manley, was saying it was the most important public vote for 150 years. Surely the parliament should be back, shouldn't be taking their recess this time of year.
I'm not sure how much parliament has to do with it at this point. I mean, again, the EU has basically, they're out on August break also, so if there's no one there to negotiate with, you can't. I mean, The problem is, I don't know what Parliament can do. The situation that the UK is in, it seems, Rex said everything was good before she called, or better before they called the election.
Sentiment.
Okay, the sentiment. But if you look at the election, the sentiment wasn't very good because they didn't like what was happening, or she would not have done, or the Conservatives would not have done as badly in the election as they did do. What you are seeing is a country that is, as we've talked about before, fairly evenly divided about what should be done. First of all, whether you should be in or out of the EU, that has not, that just because the referendum happened, and this is the one problem with democracies, the people who lost the referendum are not willing to sit down or willing to say, all right, the majority chose to leave Brexit, let's all work together to get out and get out on the best terms we can get. What those terms are is, of course, the big thing that's up in the air. But you don't even have that. You have people who are still fighting one way or another to either screw up the whole thing so that no solution is going to happen. People are still, you know, some are arguing about the economy. Some are arguing about, you know, about immigration and so on, and sovereignty and all of these things. And it's a battle within the UK that until that is somehow resolved, and I don't know that another election would do it, because the politicians are all walking on an edge. Those who are in realize they got in by a tiny, tiny margin. Those who didn't get in feel that, wow, if we keep pushing, we'll get our side in. But it is so divided, and nobody is willing to give up at all and say, all right, we have to go this way because this is what we've decided. And until the UK can come up with a plan, and I don't know whether keeping Parliament here for the month of August would have gotten you any closer to a plan or not.
We have a caller on the line. Good morning, caller. You're live on TRE. What's your name? Where are you calling from? What's your viewpoint, please?
Raymond again. I shall be brief, people. Mr. Thomas, you know exactly what's wrong because you've mentioned it on several occasions on this programme. You have said that at the end of the day, the British government has the right to decide who goes into that country from outside of the EU. That's what you have said, and that is correct. You've also mentioned the migration numbers to Britain. Yes, you've also done this. We've analysed these, and we know that for about the last 20 years, it's on average, it's a gross migration of 500,000, but 150 million leave. Sorry, that's correct, 150 million leave. So we've got 350 million, roughly 200 million in the EU. The other 150 million come predominantly from Africa and the Indian subcontinent. Now, this is, in my opinion, I've analysed this for years now. I really care about my country. For years now, that has become a problem. But no, the political parties do not seem to understand this. They don't understand what the man in the street really thinks. Hence the Brexiteers, and we are leaving the European Union. I feel so sorry for my people. And I'm not attacking them. They naively believed there was a connection between EU immigration and non-EU immigration. They really thought this. I think some of them have realised this is not the case. We need a government to stop messing about. We need a government that cares. We need to restrict non-EU immigration now. We are suffering as a result. We are suffering with overfilled classrooms. We are suffering with an acute housing shortage. It's a drain on the benefit system. We've got so many issues there. And the point is, I think what Mr. Thomas has already said is, they're coming in legally. They're getting visas. They're being issued with visas. Many of the visas are through arranged marriages where the extended family is permitted to come. Others are student visas, and some of these are extremely dodgy, right? These issues are not addressed. It's as if is it a conspiracy? Are aliens controlling this consecutive destroying our country? Is this what it, I mean? No, it's not. Though, is it? They just don't know. They've got no idea. They wouldn't. We used to have a saying where I come from, the Midlands, right, the Black Country. If someone was incompetent, we used to say they couldn't organise a booze up in a brewery.
Indeed. Well, let's hear about that. Thank you very much for those impassioned thoughts, Raymond. Let's hear from Nathan.
Well, I think you're right, Raymond, in the fact that everybody talks about control of the borders and so on, but the question really isn't getting control, it's what are you going to do when you get it? Because the UK, as you said, and as I've said before, has control of non-EU people coming in and out, and the control doesn't seem to be very strict at all. Having control of whether EU people can come in or come out, which is what many people voted for Brexit for, so that you have that control, it is the question of, okay, once you get the control, then what do you do with it? And that, of course, we have no idea. And you're right. People don't. A lot of people don't see the difference between non-EU and EU at this point. But once you get control, assuming you do with Brexit when it actually happens, and everybody again is arguing over when does this free movement stop? Does it stop in 2019? Or as Hammond and some others have said, well, no, there needs to be a transition period. So it may be 2 years, it may be 3 years after that before you actually get control of immigration from the EU. But the question is that then you will have control over all immigration from EU and non-EU and everything else. The question then is still, what are you going to do with that control? And that's the real question.
And we have a caller on the line. Thank you for holding. What's your name? Where are you calling from? What's your viewpoint, please?
No problem, Charles. Good morning, panel. Hans from Denia.
Morning, Hans.
You know how I stand to Brexit anyway, but just one thought, what I hear this morning, you're always talking about your government, your government, your government. I know from Germany and from Austria, the way the government goes is is decided and is pushed by the money. Is pushed by the Deutsche Bank, is pushed by the big money makers in Germany or in Austria. And don't you think that the government is just not going really very fast, because there's lots of people behind it, and I think even Rex would assume that most of the big money-making people in England were against the Brexit. And I'm sure it has to do something with this anyway, not just any politicians. There's many interests behind it. And as long as they can avoid it, or even make it to their benefits, then I think this is the people who really run the countries, not your elected politicians in the parliament.
The people that benefited most prior to Brexit were big business. There's undoubtedly no question about that. For them, it was manna from heaven, how they could move freely, products, everything, their workforce, whatever. It was just wonderful for them. I always felt that the man in the street of the EU was the forgotten person.
And I'm not sure, Rex. These people, especially now, they need the workforces, and if you cut them off with these immigration laws, which all you're talking
we're just discussing the fact about you hit on big business and finance, and that's my point. I agree with you that they were the main beneficiaries, not the man in the street. But if you take that away and you ask the man in the street, i.e. the man in the back lanes of Sicily in the middle of the country, or the Welsh farmer, or the people in a little village in Portugal, and you say to them, what has the EU done for you? I guarantee that most of them will say not a lot.
I do not agree at all, as you might know, that I do not understand why you decided to do the Brexit. I'm a big European fan. And at least here in Spain, where I live since 20 years and have got, I'm very much integrated in the village here and in the society, and the Spaniards absolutely do not understand why you're leaving. Well, and most of the Spaniards are happy because they have a much better life with you.
Spain is undoubtedly the highest benefiting country in the EU. But to answer your question, simply that we did not vote for federalism. That was so contentious. You know, it was forced upon us, and it was done in a very unpleasant way. And I think, really, that was the protagonistic element that made people wish for Brexit or think about Brexit.
Don't go in this point, because I really don't know that the information they had gotten and the manipulation through this very, very strange British press, which I don't see in any other country in Europe, had to do with it to get this tiny margin of not even 2% more out. But that's done. And but still, politicians are marionettes in our countries. And I think in England, I don't know, do you think your politicians are that independent that they can decide really which kind of Brexit they want to do?
Thank you, Hans.
You're welcome.
Politicians in every country have all sorts of influences after them, whether it's big business, whether it is farmers, whether it is pick any issue, and you will have that group trying to influence politicians. It's part of being a politician. You test the waters of the people who supposedly you represent, because you are there not necessarily to do what you want to do. You're there to do the will of the people who elected you to whatever office you're in. And yes, there is a lot of influence, and big business, of course, is going to have a lot of influence because it is a big thing. It has a lot of influence simply because it is big. But it's not just business. Politicians get stuck having to kowtow, if you will, to everybody who has an opinion. And that is something that, you know, is true throughout the world.
You're right, Nathan. But I think also big business, but not forgetting those dreadful bankers, what they did and how they were hoisted by their own petard, and how they thought they had everything in the bag and how clever they were. They were also a major contributor to the decline of perhaps the people's good living over the last 10 years.
Well, that may be, but bankers, along with big business, still have a tremendous amount of political influence just because they are what they are and they have the resources that they have because they represent a large section of the economy. Whether they are doing it for the good of everyone or for their own good, that's a question that continues day in and day out for all politicians. They listen to all of this push that they get from everybody and then have to make up their mind. The problem is, it seems in the UK right now, there is so much equal push from so many different sides that the politicians, there is no large enough influence pushing them one way or the other. So, you know, they just go this way, that way, this way, that way.
And we've got a caller on the line. Good morning, caller. You're live on TRE. What's your name? Where are you calling from? What's your viewpoint, please?
Good morning. My name is Rupert from Marbella.
Good morning, Rupert.
Hi there. Yes, I just wanted to make a point about the European Union. Obviously, I voted for Brexit, and although I can see the European Union has done a lot of good things for a lot of countries, my problem is the euro itself, the currency. I feel that it has massively supported and benefited countries like Germany, who now have huge cash reserves, while the southern European countries like Greece, Spain and Italy have actually suffered. And when you actually look at the wages in, for example, Malaga region, I think I read the other day that it's actually under €1,000, the average that people are taking home. Whereas you look in Germany and northern Europe and these countries and Belgium, they're absolutely booming. And the problem is with the euro that you can't devalue with your bank, your national bank. You can't devalue the currency or debase the currency. Whereas this suits Germany perfectly fine, because if they were to go back to the Deutschmark, all their exports would go up. Whereas in Italy, Spain, Greece, all these countries, if we were to devalue our currency, you know, our real estate market would go up. We'd have a hell of a lot more foreign investment flowing in. So although I can see that the European Union has done a lot of good, I can see that, you know, the euro, in my opinion, is a complete disaster. And when you speak to Spanish, you know, I speak to Spanish people and I say, was it easier to build wealth 25 years ago or 30 years ago? And they're like, we just don't know how young Spanish people could build wealth now with the euro. They're screwed. So that was my point, is I think that, you know, you can have all the laws and regulations from the euro, which are good, but, you know, the monetary supply is only benefiting a few. It's the Germans who are now taking control of the Greek ports as well, selling them off as part of the bailout deal. And no one's stopping this monster. It's not being reported in the press, in my opinion.
Thank you very much for your points in there, Rupert.
Viewpoint with Giles Brown.
You're listening to Viewpoint with me, Giles Brown, Talk Radio Europe's current affairs show, excuse me, with a panel where we discuss the issues of the day. Today we have a two-hander with Rex Leyland and Nathan Thomas. If you need to get involved, if you want to get involved with the show, 952-784-4000 is the phone number. Studio at talkradioeurope.com is the email, and the Facebook page is Talk Radio Europe Official. We also Twitter. We are at TRE Talk is good. Going to the emails, we've had two in. Only 27% of the UK population actually, in italics, actually is, voted for this catastrophic act of self-harm. No one has a plan, as nobody thought it could ever happen. Now it's as if we're stuck in quicksand and nobody except the rich, brackets as always, close brackets, will escape from this unscathed. Economically, as a country, we will now be something, an economics term, a subject I did a major in. The effects of Brexit are already being felt in my weekly shop and most certainly in my business. I wake up angry every day. And if I hear it was the will of the people one more time, I will scream, is one of the emails. And also another one, the EU immigration is the same as non-EU immigration, as Mrs. Merkel has shown. Non-EU immigrants are flooding in by the back door. Rex, you wanted to come in on something that Rupert had said a little earlier on.
Yes, I think Rupert was quite accurate in saying that the euro can stifle. I think he was absolutely spot on about Germany. The euro works exceptionally well for Germany. Then, of course, you could say, well, the Germans work the hardest, they are the most productive, etc. They have very high exports. But going back to a very tetchy point about Brexit, which is what we're basically discussing today, and the so-called mess, etc., and people have the consecutive callers have all mentioned that this sentiment and why we voted for Brexit and what was it all about. One of the other things that I recall is that, apropos Germany, is that because of Germany's strength, Germany virtually controls the EU, whether you like it or not. It has immense wealth and immense power. And I think that many Brexiteers had that fear, especially the older people, who will always say, well, we fought two world wars and blah, you know, and we didn't want to be ruled by Germany. And perhaps they now fear that they will be ruled again by Germany. And that is something that needs to be considered, as well as the fact that Rupert mentioned how much Germany owns and how much Greece owes to Germany, etc. They're in complete hock to Germany. But again, if the euro was better managed per nation, if they could work out some other balancing act, I think countries like Greece and Portugal could have benefited more than they actually have.
Indeed. Nathan?
I just want to go back to one of the comments that you read on the email about non-EU immigrants flooding into Germany, into the EU. Again, this makes the exact point I was talking about. The EU has rules about who can legally come into the EU. All the illegal immigrants that you're talking about are coming in illegally. The fact that the EU has not enforced the rules that it has or has not made more stringent rules, the UK is going to be in the same situation. They are, okay, they'll get control, one assumes, when they leave the EU, they will get control of their border. They have rules. They have rules now for non-EU people. They can make whatever rules they want for EU people once they have that power. But the question is, what rules are they going to make? And once they make them, are they going to enforce them? The EU has rules. All of those immigrants, the boat people, the people coming across the Med for the past 4 or 5 years, and you're into, I'm not sure how many millions now. And again, there were just stories this morning about, you know, all the people in Calais still trying to get across the channel. But the point is, if you don't enforce the rules, having the power to make those rules is kind of a worthless power. Right. And the EU has not enforced the rules that it has, so Is the UK, once they get the power to enforce these rules, going to do any better?
I think, Nathan, you've hit the nail on the head there, because I believe that if the EU had managed their immigration policy better, going back, say, even only 10 years ago, but just say 8 years ago, probably Europe wouldn't be in the position it's in now with this massive influx of refugees and migrants. And one has to decide who is a migrant and who is a refugee. A refugee should be given status over an economic migrant. But this should have been managed properly from Brussels years ago. And had it been the case, we would not, the whole of Europe would not be in the position it's in now. It was on the Spanish news yesterday on TRE about another break-in in Ceuta or Melilla or whatever. They jumped the fence. And I mean, what is going on, for God's sake? Thousands and thousands of people are coming here. We can't cope. We can't cope. We're at saturation. Ask the Swedish, ask the Norwegians how they're doing with their immigrants. Ask the Germans. It's getting a bit tricky.
Well, and again, talking about enforcement, the story yesterday, and I forget whether it was Ceuta or Melilla, but they said there were more than 100 that broke through and so many, you know, were returned and so many were in. But they said those who got in will actually be brought to the Spanish mainland. And I'm not sure what happens then, but basically they have gotten what they wanted. They've gotten into Europe.
And we've got a caller on the line. Good morning, caller. You're live on TRE. What's your name? Where are you calling from? What's your viewpoint, please?
Yeah, good morning. Sharon Alicante. First of all, a lot of the people, the early migrants, were from the Middle East. I think we have to admit that. And, of course, look who led the war in the Middle East along with the US and possibly France, UK. So the UK has a lot to answer for regarding the people coming from the Middle East. The people coming from Morocco and Africa and all those sorts of places, that more has to be done. But it's a bit of a joke, us pointing at the European Union when we've cut our own police and border force by God knows how much. I really don't think we're in a position to preach to the EU on this one. And in the Times, headline in the Times on Sunday was how the UK, which has perfect control over non-EU citizens, and to be fair, the article was very, very fair. It said that we are allowing non-EU citizens into the universities because they pay a lot to the detriment of our own students. They're admitting almost as many, if not more, from abroad, non-EU, than they are from the UK because they were prepared to pay. This is what happens when you privatise and monetise everything, isn't it? So let's not blame the EU for something that we have. Okay, the EU could have handled it better, but we weren't prepared for the mess that we created in the Middle East with the US and France, were they? I mean, you could fairly understand that. So before we point fingers, let's look at what we've done and our own history of how we've dealt with it. And there was a Dutch boat that was interviewed. They were talking about border force, and the presenter said, I think we ought to look at our own situation before we point fingers. And this Dutch vessel said that every time they go to a UK port, and they named St. Peter Port, and I think it was either Portsmouth or Southampton, they said there's no check. There's absolutely no check. Whereas the other EU ports, they get checked. So I just think we have to be really careful before we point fingers at people. Thanks a lot.
Thank you for that. Yeah. Thank you for that call in, Sharon. You're listening to Viewpoint, as always, a busy Viewpoint today. We've got a caller on the line. Good morning, caller. Thank you for holding. What's your name? Where are you calling from? What's your viewpoint, please? Hello, caller. You're live on TRE. And as they say, there he was gone. 952-784-4000, the phone number. Studio at talkradioeurope.com is the email, and the Facebook page is Talk Radio Europe Official. Jacob Rees-Mogg also waded into the arguments on the news that the UK was prepared to pay the £36 billion EU divorce bill, saying there's no logic to that. This figure. Legally, we owe nothing. And I know that you've been impressed by Rees-Mogg, Rex.
Yes, I thought he performed exceptionally well on the last Question Time programme prior to the summer break. I thought he came across extremely well. He was very articulate. He's reasonably intelligent. And I feel that he might be a safe pair of hands. I'm not 100%. I'd say about 85% that he would probably make a good party leader and might also be of great benefit in sorting out the exit and to putting some a modicum of sense into the negotiations.
A modicum of sense. We've got just time for a quick call before we had the international news at the top of the hour and then the Spanish news. Good morning, caller. You're live on TRE. What's your name? Where are you calling from? What's your viewpoint, please? You've got less than a minute. The mystery caller again. So we go live to the other... Hello, you're live on... Hello, you're live on TRE.
Can you hear me?
I can hear you loud and clear.
Brilliant. Okay, fine. Yes, are you still talking... I'm driving, sorry. Are you still talking about the Brexit situation?
I think we'll be talking about that until the day itself.
Oh, okay, fine. I just wanted to make a little point and see what anyone says. In 1938, my parents had to escape Austria. Okay, the only way they could get in to Britain was to be sponsored. There was no other way that you could do it. You could not just come along and just go into the country. And I just wondered why that has changed so much.
Wondered why being sponsored has changed from when your parents came in.
Well, you couldn't just leave the country and just and go and come into another country. Go on a ship or go on a boat and just go into the UK. You had to be sponsored.
Okay. We're going to run out of time. International News, thank you for your call in. Your international news up next, and then Spanish news, and then we're back for the second hour of Viewpoints.